Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Lynn Friedman wears two very distinctive and different hats. A contemporary abstract and landscape artist, Lynn Friedman's paintings explore the emotional impact of season, weather, light, and time. They move from the outdoors into the studio. She's painted in Spain, southern France, Costa Rica, Ireland, and New Mexico, and for the past several years has spent time painting en plein air in Taos and Abiquiu, where the legendary Georgia O'Keeffe lived and worked. Listed in Who's Who in American Art, Lynn has been awarded 7 artist residency grants. Her paintings have been shown in solo exhibitions, and in 2013, her work was selected by the U.S. State Department Art in Embassies program for exhibition in Djibouti, East Africa, and Colombo, Sri Lanka. She's had solo exhibitions at the Booth Western Art Museum in Georgia and the James McNeill Whistler Museum in Massachusetts, as well as numerous shows in New York City. Her work hangs in many corporate and private collections. Then there's Lynn Friedman, the licensed private investigator, whose assignments have taken her around the world. They include looking for hidden millions offshore, identifying the source of counterfeit handbags, and tracking down the birth mother of a 60-year-old woman who was abandoned when she was 18 months old. Lynn got into the world of private investigating, working as a college art teacher and not making a whole lot of money. Lynn, welcome, and thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure.
All right, Lynn. Painter, private eye, crazy, no?
It is a crazy existence, but I really love it. It's they're very different personas almost. I mean, as a private investigator, you think very differently than you do as an artist. As a private investigator, you're always kind of searching out a way of finding the facts that your client wants. And you have to be creative, but you're looking for factual material. I've had some really, really interesting cases over the years, and it's been a lot of fun. It's never a boring job.
But it's certainly not as emotional as painting, correct?
Exactly. It's a great balance to painting, because as a painter, you know, you're always faced with the, quote, empty canvas, and there's no rules, and there's no facts base to work from that you're heading toward. You're always in an ambiguous kind of subconscious, conscious territory where you're kind of trying to find your way to solve a problem that you've created yourself. One thing about plein air painting or landscape painting is you actually have a subject matter that you're reacting to in front of you. But if you're working abstractly, you're working primarily from inner pressure, inner emotive states. You might have some reaction to landscape or the figure or something real physically in the physical world. A connection to something in the physical world, but it's much more ambiguous. And so I find it a really great balance. And they really are not related at all. I mean, I almost am a different person as an investigator.
So could we call you a little schizophrenic? Or do we call you multidimensional?
Multidimensional.
Okay, that's
I like
fair.
That much better.
But I think that's what's so fascinating, that you can be all the way over here and make that transition to being all the way over here.
It's true. Not everybody is like that. I mean, I meet a lot of artists who are very nonlinear. I mean, they can't even keep a address book going, you know, an appointment book going. And then I meet investigators who really are not very visual.
Just the facts, ma'am, huh?
Yeah, they're much more linear.
I want to talk about some of your work as a private investigator, but not right now. What I want to start with is, how did you know you could paint?
You know, I always painted, even when I was a young child. And I was thinking recently that some of my earliest memories are visual memories, like the color of a piece of fabric or the pattern on a floor. And those I was always extremely visual. And then even as a child, I painted. One of the nice things that happened is there was a brotherhood contest, and I think I was 11, and I won for my painting. And
what do you mean a brotherhood contest?
It was Brotherhood Week in February. And in each school, and my painting won for people of different ethnicities in a garden, and I was awarded the prize by Jackie Robinson.
Oh, wow.
So that impressed people. That really impresses people
more than
who are
your
sports.
Art.
That's my only connection with sports, is that
impressive
that event.
Enough, yes.
So I always was an artist. And I
encouraged by your family, by your parents?
Well, modestly. Not, you know, there's always that question of, well, what are you going to do with it? Mm-hmm. You know, how are you going to make a living and things like that?
Because painting is also solitary.
Well, I started out going to the Brooklyn Museum Art School, which at that time was a fabulous art school. It was started by Hans Hofmann prior to my time, of course. And they had multiple classes, and you'd have to walk through the galleries to get to the art studios. And it was just so exciting. You had this wonderful connection with the art historical past as you go through these galleries. And the teachers were wonderful, and some of them, you know, were known. My father used to drive me to the Brooklyn Museum on Saturday mornings, and I'd go to drawing classes. I remember the first...
So that's not modest encouragement. That's overt encouragement.
That was, yeah, that was really good encouragement, I have to admit. Yeah, there was. That was a lot of effort on his part. I remember the first drawing class I went to. I was 16 and a half, and of course, I was kind of young, and it was a nude model. And I was so nervous. I remember I was sweating. Because for a 16-year-old, you know, to be presented with a nude model on a stand was a pretty shocking thing. Of course, I spent 10 years after that drawing for models. And, you know, once you...
Get one under your belt.
After that, it was nothing.
Right.
And it's still nothing.
Mm-hmm,
you know, it's just normal stuff, you know, seeing these bodies. And I spent about 10 years being a graphic artist doing drawings, big figurative stuff. And then I switched to landscape because I felt that that was, I don't know, more challenging in some ways.
So you knew that art was, quote, your thing, and that's what you also studied when you went to college.
Yes. I became an art teacher, yeah.
An art teacher.
Right, yeah.
But at what point were you painting and creating and thinking about selling your work? Is that what's in your head, or is it this incredible need to express yourself? And if the works are sold, what a bonus?
Yeah, well, I would say that's right. I mean, I didn't really think about selling. I was much more motivated to create. I think most artists are like that. There's an inner need to express themselves visually or explore visual ideas. And that eventually... You look at the work and say, well, would other people like this work? And I'd like to see it out in the world. And then, of course, you begin to accumulate a fair amount of work and you'd like to see some of it sold. And it would be nice for people to own it. It's kind of like your children are out in the world. And when people love it, I think that's the best thing. When people really respond to the work and want to have it in their living space or in a public space. It's very exciting, that part of it.
You certainly have to amass a body of work in order for it to be exhibited, correct?
Right.
I mean, do you have an agent?
No. Fine artists, you know, quote fine artists, as opposed to graphic designers, don't generally have agents. You have to do your own promoting and marketing of your own work. A lot of artists don't like doing that, and so they don't. And they end up dying with, you know, 500 pieces in their studio. But other artists understand that process. You have to apply for grants. You have to apply for shows at galleries. You have to enter juried shows in the beginning to get a few pieces out into the world. Now, of course, it's all changed. It used to all be slides, and you would send slides, which would drive you crazy. You'd have 10 copies of every painting you ever made. You're constantly sifting slides. But that all changed in the 90s, and, they started with artist websites, and then JPEGs were sent out. And at first, people thought that no one would buy art looking at it on a computer.
But it made more sense to look at it on a slide?
No, it didn't, but that would be just to approve you for a show.
Ah, okay.
But people actually buy art having viewed it on a website. And that's been going on now for, you know, maybe 15 years at least, maybe, but really probably longer. And I think that was a big surprise to a lot of people in the art market. A lot of the galleries, you know, wouldn't put work up online because they didn't expect to sell it that way. And they sell that way.
And do you sell that way?
I do somewhat, yes. I have sold to people in other parts of the country who I've never met, who've only saw the work on the website and then wanted to buy it. It's a hard thing to reconcile in a way, because let's just think about the Metropolitan Museum of Art. They put up their collection online. You can look at the paintings in the Met online. But you know, firsthand experience.
Oh, there's nothing like it.
Right. If you talk to Philip de Montebello, you know, the former head.
Philippe de Montebello.
Art is firsthand experience. You have to have a one-to-one interaction with the piece to really...
Oh, I agree.
To experience it fully.
And have an emotional reaction to walk into a room and see something hanging. And that's how I've bought my art.
You know, I mean, if you look at a Rembrandt in a photograph or on a JPEG on a computer, you really can't see the texture of the paint, the application of the paint, where it's thick, where it's thin, the transparency in certain sections. I mean, just an example.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just such a different experience than a JPEG. But that's how the, you know, things have evolved in the last period of time.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Lynn Friedman, contemporary and abstract artist and private investigator. Can somebody make a living regardless of how talented they are?
If you have a promoter,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, there are certain galleries that promote certain artists, if you network your way into certain groups of people, you might be able to get a lot of your work out there, even though it may not be very good work. Most artists, I don't think, make a living at their work. They may make a partial living from their work.
Struggling artist is not a misnomer.
Well, I don't know if the word is struggling. It's just that you'd have a recognition that you need a second job. And most artists are, you know, they do construction, they do graphic design.
Or they teach.
They teach. Mm-hmm. They have another path for income.
Are you at a good place in terms of where you feel about your art?
Yeah. Well, I have my work out in a lot of places by now.
As I mentioned,
and you know, it takes a long time to figure out how to do all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a big studio, so I have everything in my studio. I have a database where I have all my work recorded. There's mm-hmm. great art databases now.
Mm-hmm.
First galleries use them, now artists use them. So you have total, you know, your inventory,
mm-hmm.
and you can remember which piece was sold to who and when,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing. Because it gets complicated as the years pass and you accumulate more work and more sales. And sometimes someone will say to you, I want this painting for this show. And then you say, oh, my God, where's that painting?
Yeah.
I can't remember. And you're frantically looking through your paint racks for a painting that you just don't remember where you put it. You know, it's a process.
Do you feel that you're, for now, today, in a very good place in terms of your art?
I think as an artist, you're always looking to doing the best paintings you possibly can do. I'm a painter.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I don't do sculpture, really. I do some collage. And you're always trying to make a more definitive statement about your work. So, you know, you have pieces that you've done that you're happy with or you're satisfied with, that you have closure with, but you're always looking to the next work.
Hmm.
It never really ends. And I can't remember who said it, but you know, it was something like when he got to be about 95, he thought he might begin to learn really how to paint.
Do you feel that way?
Not in the question of get it. It's just that I think I just have more experience, so I have more basis to work with.
How has it been to watch yourself evolve from what you started to paint back then to where you might be today?
Well, I do more abstract work now, and mm-hmm. I've just kind of in the last 2-3 years worked much more abstractly. So, you know, what's interesting is sometimes you do a body of work and you don't really know where it came from, and somehow later on, it's subliminal
mm-hmm.
at some level. You learn things about what you did that you didn't really know you were doing when you did them. And it's only when you see the work up, you have a show in a gallery, you put up, you know, 15 pieces, and you look at them, and then you realize certain things about the work that you didn't realize when you did it. So there's sometimes a subliminal or unknown message that's coming through the work
mm-hmm.
that you didn't intend consciously.
Yeah. But that in and of itself is very exciting.
That is very exciting. It really is exciting. Because you didn't do it consciously. You didn't know that you were creating some mysterious process. Something came through you that you were unaware of.
What's it like to paint on plein air?
Well, you got to schlep all your materials outdoors. You have to have a good setup so you don't have to, you know, you can carry everything. The plus part of it is you get to spend time in a very focused way in very interesting places. I love that about plein air painting. And you see wonderful things. You see the clouds moving and changing. You see, you know, some animals doing whatever they're going to be doing. And you're there watching them. And it's a meditation, outdoor painting. It really is.
Is it hypnotic?
I wouldn't call it hypnotic. I mean, you are in a kind of a different space. You know, you only notice what you only observe what you want to see. You don't, if someone comes up to you and asks you a question, you can't really talk to them. You know, you have to kind of say, I'm busy. You're not available for the outside world.
Your work is not completed outside, is it?
Well, sometimes it is. Sometimes it's completed outside and sometimes it's not. But my visual memory is so strong from working outdoors that I can take a piece that is well along outdoors and finish it in the studio. I'm not wedded to realistic accuracy. I'm much more wedded to making the painting work.
And speak to you?
Yeah. And feel complete, where I have closure on the painting. If the painting, because the painting will talk to you, it'll tell you, you know, that green in the upper left doesn't work, mm-hmm. or, you know, you need to change a color in the lower right, or this is too long, this isn't straight enough, this is not balanced. It talks to you in different ways, the painting. Visual recall is probably a big part of my process.
So you don't take photographs?
I occasionally take photographs, but I never use them.
So it's what's in your head?
Yes, because if I look at the photograph and I look at my painting, there's really no relationship.
Mm.
I mean, some people do work from photographs. I don't really do that. I really need the raw experience of the outdoor.
Do you paint with other people?
I don't paint with other. Well, I have one friend I paint outdoors with, but we don't work next to each other. You know, we just work in the kind of general area mm-hmm. together. So we're basically alone. And in my studio, I'm alone with music or radio.
You paint every day?
Not every single day, because I'm a private investigator.
Yeah, we're going to get to that in a minute. Yeah,
I'd say, you know, about three, four days a week I'm painting
and
in my
miss,
studio.
And do you miss it when more time goes by?
I can't really live without painting. I really need it. You know, some people have to meditate every day. Painting is my meditation.
Isn't it fabulous that you could make a career out of something that's so vital to your life?
I feel lucky to have, you know, to be an artist. I think artists are very special in that way. They have a way of being in the world. And I include dance and, you know, musicians and, you know, all those kinds of people. Their way of being in the world is very rich. I think that a lot of people who don't have kind of a passion for a creative area miss out.
But then there are the people who have that passion and it's not recognized.
Well, of course, you know, there's hundreds and thousands of artists who work and are not recognized or who don't make an effort to get their work out or don't get their work out.
Or even if they do get their work out, it doesn't necessarily mean that someone's going to buy it.
I think as an artist, your basic premise is you do it because you want to do it and you need to do it.
Yeah, you have to do it.
And if you don't sell, so be it.
Yeah, but you also have to survive.
Well, that's the other job you have.
Exactly.
That's what's keeping you surviving.
So the other job you have.
Yeah.
Go for it, girl.
Well, you
How
know,
does somebody become a private investigator?
Well, you know, I always loved Nancy Drew mysteries. When
I read them too, but I'm not a PI.
The Mystery Under the Staircase, you know, I just loved them. And she had her little roadster car. I don't know. I've always been, I like mystery. I like intrigue. I like research. I kind of feel life is research. And I don't mean that just as an investigator. I mean that in all aspects,
mm-hmm.
that you're always challenged in life to find ways or pathways. And the more research you do, the better off you are, because you have the most alternatives and options available to you. So being a research investigator has been really great for me in lots of ways, outside of doing it as a career.
But, I mean, how do you get involved in that?
People have good luck in certain ways. This is one of my experiences of really good luck. I was in graduate school at Columbia Teachers College. I was doing a doctorate on art education.
Oh, that's so similar to finding millions offshore. Yes.
Right. It was. Okay. I was doing it with the Egyptian collection and sixth graders on best ways to teach art appreciation. And I got very, very good at doing research.
Mm-hmm.
And I always had a second job. So I used to get temp jobs. And one of the places I was sent to was a small private investigations firm. And they asked me to review lawsuits and summarize them. Well, that was a very comfortable thing for me to do. And I was offered a project job mm-hmm. there. And that was a company that was small at the time, but began to grow humongously at that time. Databases had just started coming in. It was the early 80s. The company had maybe 15 people. It grew to 175. It was only an office in New York. It went to Hong Kong. It went to Paris.
Did you find that all very sexy when you started working there?
It was an adjustment because these people were very smart. And you had to be very quick.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, this was a different world than I had spent time in. But I worked hard at it to be able to do it.
Uh-huh.
And the company grew really large, and I grew with it. And, you know, I was hiring other investigators and researchers, and I was traveling to, you know, Buenos Aires on research assignments. And I grew in the business, basically, and I learned the business being there.
And you were still painting at the time.
I was still teaching. I was teaching in Manhattanville College. I would go from working all day to teaching at night at Manhattanville College up in Purchase, New York. And I was doing both for a while. And at a certain point, I gave up the teaching because it was adjunct work.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Lynn Friedman, contemporary and abstract artist who also happens to be a private investigator. All right, so you're typing these summaries and you're traveling to places. Now, how did you move up into the actual run an investigation level?
Well, I just I learned the business. There are certain steps you take in investigation. You know, you get identifiers on the individual or the company. You read the filings if it's a publicly held company. You contact sources who know that industry. You call people on the phone and ask them questions. You travel to a foreign location and meet with sources.
Were you undercover?
I have used aliases upon occasion. I have aliases.
Let's pick a case. Should we do the one about the woman who was abandoned at 18
okay,
months?
Yeah, that's a fairly recent case. This woman was a porn star, a beautiful woman, now in her 60s. And she then was director of a feminist porn company that made feminist porn. It's a very well-known company. And she was abandoned by her mother when she was 18 months old. She grew up with her grandmother. She did have a father, but he was a musician and traveled. And she wanted to find out where her mother was and more about her. I found her mother in another state, and her mother had died, and we got the death certificate. And the real key question she had was, what did her mother die of?
Had her mother recently died?
5 years ago.
Oh, so it's not that you just missed her.
No, I didn't just mm-hmm. miss her. She had died of cancer, and my client had the same kind of
uh-huh.
cancer. So that was really very emotional, you know, because she obviously had inherited the gene.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question was, well, what could she find out about her mother? And she remembered a half-brother from when she was 2 and 3 years old. And where was he? So I began doing research in this, it was like Ohio, you know, not near here. And I found that her mother had married 2 times after she had left. And I found the half-brother. And I was able to give her, ultimately, the addresses and phone numbers of her family through her mother that she'd never met her whole life.
Wow.
And she had a, you know, she got to meet them. It was very, very emotional for her. That was a really nice case, you know, to be able to help a person solve some major life.
And she was never adopted. She was raised by her grandmother.
Right. No, she was never adopted. Well, she ended up being in foster care for a few years. I think she had some, you know, early childhood things that were hard. You know, as an investigator, you try to kind of keep your distance a bit.
And not get emotionally involved, you mean?
You don't want to get too emotional involved, and you don't want to know about things that are irrelevant to the investigation.
Mm-hmm,
for
mm-hmm.
instance, you know, what her childhood was like, where she moved to, what happened with her grandmother. You don't want to know all that. You really just want to stay focused on your assignment.
Right. It clouds other things.
And also, you know, investigations cost money, so you don't want to incur time and expense in directions that are not relevant to what your investigative goals are.
What's another case that kind of really gripped you?
Well, there was a big bank on Third Avenue that went under, and the president of the bank went to jail. He went to what's called Club Fed in Lompoc in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And we were hired by the FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, to find the money that had disappeared.
How much money are you talking about?
Oh, $40
million. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Not chump change.
No, these are always big, big cases.
Mm-hmm.
And this man had been from Argentina, Buenos Aires. And we were able to get, he was in jail, his notes on where he had his money stored. It was written in Spanish from Hebrew, and we had to have it translated into English mm-hmm. and then figure out what his shorthand really meant.
Stood for.
Mm-hmm. When you're in prison, this is pre-cell phones. The pay phones say on them, you know, you're being recorded.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had tapes at the prison of all his phone conversations to people outside the prison. And they were all in Spanish. And they were all translated into English. And I was able to figure out all the assets he still held because he was talking to the people who owned the hotels that he owned in Buenos Aires.
Mm-hmm.
And there were other things, too. So eventually I went to Buenos Aires and had to meet with a number of people because we wanted to follow certain trails. And that was very exciting. And then we went to the prison to depose him because he was supposed to be released.
Mm-hmm.
That was the most interesting thing because you don't usually see the target of your investigation.
Mm.
He was a very charming, good-looking man. And in very
maybe
good...
he would have bought one of your paintings.
I don't mix art and investigations. Mm-hmm. So the lawyer who I was with was deposing him and asking him questions. And I was sitting there knowing the answers, and he lied about everything. And he did it so well. If you looked at him, you never would have known he was lying.
Mm.
And there was nothing I could do about it. And he knew I knew. He knew I knew everything about him. He was sent back to Buenos Aires. They collected partially on the debt.
And the rest is out there somewhere.
Well, wherever it is. I think, yeah. He had some involvement with some federal government agency. It had to do during the Contra.
Iran-Contra.
Iran-Contra,
uh-huh.
period. Yeah. It was an exciting case, and it went on for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was quite something.
You know, we could go on and on and on, but we're out of time. And it just goes so fast, especially when a guest is so interesting.
Oh, thanks so much.
So I really appreciate your coming today, Lynn. It was really fascinating to get to know you. I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate it, too. And it's lovely to be here.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.